Thank you so much all for coming tonight. Really great to see Baruch Hashem, such a fantastic turnout. Thank you really for being here. And we look forward to a fantastic evening together. Before we begin, I'm not going to steal a precious time from our presenters tonight, but a few thank yous are in order. I want to begin by thanking Mrs. Rebbetzin Marjorie Glatt, who you will not hear from tonight. She's very much going to be a listener, but without her, we could not be here tonight. She didn't just work tirelessly to create this program together as a team, but she put so much care and concern into every detail of the program, as she does the entire YU Connects program in general. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all your hard work to get her tonight. She deserves a round of applause. I also want to thank Tina Appel and Adina Frankel, who this is actually a result of a meeting we had, I would say, 2 or 3 months ago, the beginning of a discussion, and your thoughts and your energy and your creativity is so appreciated, and again, I think that tonight really is a credit to the two of you, and really thank you for your ideas and your insights. We value them very, very much. Applause is only 10 seconds per person, okay? I also want to mention our Simcha Connection, who also collaborates beautifully in the community to be able to facilitate many different shidduchim, so thank you for your efforts. I want to thank, as a whole, YU Connects for their vision, their energy, and really for starting a very important conversation. Speaking of which, I was asked to announce, and I think it's important, that you can give to YU Connects if you want to support them. Please do that. There are materials in the back to look at what they offer and what they can do for our community in general, for Klal Yisrael as a whole, through daily giving or through the YU Connect site as well. Just to introduce, before I tell you who our wonderful panelists are for tonight, and thank you all for being here, somebody asked me 2 weeks ago, who's the program for? And at first I was going to respond with some long-winded response, which rabbis sometimes do, but I instead decided to respond by saying the truth is it's really for everyone. Meaning, the concept of shidduchim and the commitment towards making matches and enabling our young men and young women to have healthy relationships and get them on the path towards marriage is not just for the singles, it's not just for the parents, it's not just for the morot and the rabbis, it's really a global community partnership. And I think that's what I want to highlight at the beginning of our discussion for tonight, that it really is about a partnership, and everyone has a role to play in hopefully being able to enable to produce many shidduchim. So please realize that, and please share with others who are not here tonight, they'll hear the recording hopefully, that this is just the beginning, at least for our community, Mirtzah Hashem, of a discussion and commitment to hopefully better the process and enable, again, our young men and young women to be able to create healthy relationships and, God willing, on the road towards marriage. I want to thank our panelists tonight for being here. I'm tempted to read your entire bios because they really are so impressive, but I'm seeing a lot of no's. That's a hand between those. Mrs. Rachel Horkman, who is a licensed psychotherapist specializing in relationships, intimacy, and trauma. She graduated from CUNY Queens with a BA in history. She maintains a private practice in Manhattan and lectures to diverse groups locally and abroad, and serves as a consultant for rabbis, educators, and mental health professionals, and has trained college teachers throughout the programs of Shalom Task Force, Orthodox Union, Chabad, YU, the RSA, and Nishman. Mrs. Minnie Eisenman, a familiar face in our community who grew up in West Hempstead, a local hero. Her children live here, which is also a connection. The Eisenmans, her brother-in-law and sister-in-law live here. Supposed to have her here back in our community. Is a graduate of Stern College, a master's from Azrieli in Jewish education, MSW from the Wurzweiler School of Social Work. She is a Tarat HaMashpacha educator and dating coach, as well as staff connector, and is a certified Shalom Workshop instructor as well. Mindy has actually produced Baruch Hashem 50 engagements plus through the site, and is always busy as she is tonight.
Almost 60.
Almost 60. It says 50 on this paragraph here. I'm so sorry to minimize, but... and actually tonight, just to show you how impressive it is, she actually will be on the phone tonight, probably late at night, doing worship with Amir Hashem on the way home. And last but certainly not least, Rabbi Leibowitz, who will appreciate your time being here tonight. Actually, on my way to a bris this morning, I listened to a shiur by Rabbi Leibowitz, and at the beginning he said, I'm late for the shiur. I traveled from Riverdale to get to Far Rockaway. I get the sense that he's traveling a lot to be at different places, Baruch Hashem, teaching Torah all over the place. And we really appreciate you taking the time to be here tonight. He's the rabbi of Beit Knesset North Woodmere since 2004, a Rebbe at Reitz Smicho program, and we appreciate your being here tonight as well. Just a reminder for tonight, the questions were submitted beforehand, and so please remember that we're going to allow our wonderful panelists to be able to respond as they would like to, and hopefully we'll all gain a Mirat Hashem from the discussion tonight and from the questions. Okay. A question that was submitted by many of the emails, I'll just address first, and we'll maybe start with Mrs. Herkman, because this is addressed to, sorry if I go on the spot first.
I think you would go first.
I apologize, okay, we didn't draw straws. In terms of profiles, and in terms of shadchanim, and in terms of resumes, many people sometimes get a name, and they analyze and they look at it and they look at the specs, look at the details, and they either say no, they say yes, and a lot of times, whether it's the parents or friends have a difficult time, I would say, cajoling or encouraging people to say yes to what could be practically a very good idea. So number one is every suggestion is worth a shot. And number two is, if some ideas in fact are worthwhile, what's the best way to encourage a young man or young woman to be able to open their mind to give a shidduch a proper chance.
Okay.
I think
it's stuck
under
the
mind.
There we go, thank you.
So, hi. So, I first wanted to give a little disclaimer that we are in a group setting, and these topics around relationships and dating and building marriages can sometimes lend themselves to more shame and stigma. So sometimes people come to group events hoping that they're going to get answers for private situations. And there are other topics that don't carry the same kind of stigma, right? So if someone came to a nutrition lecture, let's say, it would be a tall order for them to expect that they're going to walk out with a personalized diet for their specific body and their specific sensitivities. But because we sometimes feel like, oh, I don't want to like go talk to someone about dating stuff, so we come to events, so I just want to put that out there, that there's a huge benefit to having these group conversations, but one of the limitations is that we can end up with generalizations that may not, that not only may not be helpful for everyone, but can actually sometimes be detrimental. So I just want to like put that out there as a disclaimer. So in terms of the question of how do we get someone, let's say, to agree to go on a date? I think there's different levels to this whole system that kind of come along with this sort of frame. Because what I find ends up happening in our dating world is that we often have parents who are, let's say, the ones who are in touch with the shadchanim, with the matchmakers, and they're trying, let's say, to convince their child to agree to go on a date with somebody. And so you have all these middlemen who all mean well. What I find that one of the issues is that if we want our youth, if we want people to act like adults and be able to get married as adults, then infantilizing them in the dating system does not help that. So I feel very strongly that if somebody is ready to date, they should be the one in touch with the shadchan. And they should be the one saying, this is what I'm looking for. They should be the one who's saying, this is what happened on the date. This idea that people come home from a date or they're deciding that they don't want to go on a date with someone. The fact that very often I find that conversation is not actually happening between the single themselves and the shadchan. It's happening between the mother of the single and the shadchan, and not actually the person who's dating. So, for example, let's say you have a guy who the word on the street is, oh, he only wants a size 2. He's so picky. And he's not necessarily the one even talking to the shadchan. His mom is talking to the shadchan. And my answer is always, Everyone loves to blame the men, but any guy who says that they have to have a size 2, the only reason why that guy knows what a size 2 is because some woman taught him that that's important. So we could blame men all we want. Oh, men are pigs. Women, we don't do such a service for each other when it comes to that. So in terms of this question of how do we get people to agree or should we take every suggestion, I think, like many situations, I think it depends. I think in many cases, people, it would benefit to say yes more than people are saying yes. There's such a low threshold now for dismissal, right? You look online, you have 350 mutual friends, you call one person and they say, I don't see it, and that's it. I should have, right? Because we're all experts, right? Because and we're all experts at seeing it, right? And that's why everyone's married? No. But that's my feeling. I do think that people, I don't think it should be a policy of every suggestion. But I also think at a certain point, when we're pushing and pushing and pushing someone to go on a date with someone, and they keep saying no, but we're also telling them that we trust them as an adult, it sends mixed messages to them about our general trust of them in terms of their ability to be getting married.
Thank you so much. Very insightful. Rabbi Leibowitz. Oftentimes, we'll use a name. Let's say a young man named Yosef gets a suggestion and he calls the Rebbe. And then he goes on the first date and he calls the Rebbe. And he goes on a third date and calls the Rebbe, and you get the pattern here that's going on. The question was raised many times, what is the role of a Rebbe or Rebbetzin, I would say, in terms of giving the young man or young woman autonomy to make their own decisions versus guiding them and maybe encouraging them to kind of decide things for themselves and not giving them, I guess, a point of reference to go back every single time they go on a date.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, before I answer the question, I just want to thank you for having me here. You have two experts sitting to my right, and I don't know anything about dating, but I'm going to share with you just a perspective as a Rebbe of young men, which I assume is why I was invited. The question as posed, which by the way was not one of the questions that was pre-submitted to me, so it's a bit of a surprise. Okay, no problem. But the question as posed was sort of like a layup. You know, should the Rebbe be overbearing and tell the boy who to marry and pick his wife for him, or should he be supporting and talk things through? Well, obviously the latter, not the former. But I do want to take it in a little bit of a different direction. I was talking to a group of friends earlier today. We were zocheh to help make shavu brachos for a friend of ours, and I said, okay, I'm doing this shidduch symposium, and I don't know anything about shidduchim, so give me information. So it was all people who were in the parsha, the children were in the parsha of shidduchim. So one of the points that was made, I forget by which of our friends, was that it was a mother of an engaged young lady, and she said, I know when my daughter was dating, I was the worst advisor for her because I was so emotionally connected to what she was going through. I was so emotionally compromised because I wanted it to happen, and I wanted it to happen now, and she just really needed some time. And thank God she had a mentor. Thank God she had a mentor who was normal, who was able to see what her needs were, who was able to, you know, tell her, look, as long as you're progressing and you do this at your own pace and it will work out, and was able to give her the chizuk to be able to get through it. She said, thank God she had that, because if she only had me, it would have been a mess. Now, that's not to say that parents don't play a role. Parents play a very critical role, and obviously if a child-parent relationship has been healthy for the past few decades, where the child is in the parasha of shidduchim, it would be natural that the Rebbe or the teacher is one of the advisors. But of course, the parent has to be someone, again, if it's a healthy relationship, the parent will typically be one of the primary advisors. If the question is coming from the perspective of a Rebbe or a teacher, should you be the one to tell them that you have to do this or you must do that, I think that is a terrible idea. just not only for the dater, but for the Rebbe or the teacher. Because if someone ends up in a bad marriage because you told them that they have to, I mean, that's your fault for the rest of their lives. And that is really, really not a wise thing to do. If someone is old enough to date, they're old enough to choose their spouse, you just try to help them see things that they may be missing, think about things that they may not be thinking about, refer them to a therapist if they need a therapist or a dating coach. I was just talking to a young man who I could see he just needed a push, and I didn't have the expertise or the time to give him that help and that chizuk that he needed. So I sent him to Minty, and thank God, you know, they're doing nicely. God willing, it should work out. They're doing, but he needed that. I think that's much more the role of a Rebbe or a mentor.
Thank you so much. Mrs. Eisenman, I'm changing the name because I'm not sure if it's somebody in actual case here. My daughter, called her Rachel. Random name. Came to mind first, Baruch Hashem. That's my wife. Great shidduch, by the way. Great shidduch. My daughter Rachel, in her early 20s, she tells me that I need to be more proactive in networking and finding match ideas for her. I'm naturally shy and feel uncomfortable asking others if they know young men for her to date. Whose responsibility is it? What is a parent's role in getting matches for children? And even if I want to help, I'm not sure how. My parents were not involved in my dating life. What resources are there for me?
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Dallin. Firstly, I just want to tell everyone that I'm really honored to be here. Sitting up here on the panel, it's so special for me, being someone that grew up in this community. I'm really so grateful to be here, and it's so lovely that all of you came out to be here tonight. So we actually welcome all calls that come. Everyone should be involved in their child's life if they want to be involved and if their child wants them to be involved, right? You need to take the cue from your child. However, I think the running theme that seems to be happening tonight is what I'm going to tell you, which is that if your child is old enough to get married, they're also old enough to be proactive in their dating life. You should encourage them to talk to friends, go to events, go to friends for Shabbos, and meet new people. We as parents for so many years have made play dates for our children. We have encouraged them to do certain extracurricular activities. We have been so focused on running their lives that as they get older, we also need to take a little step back and give them that autonomy. As a matchmaker, I gain so much and I learn about a person when I speak to them directly. So often parents will call me and say, I want to tell you about my daughter, I want to tell you about my son, and I always say, that's great, and I will listen to you, but first I need to speak to them directly, right? Every parent thinks their child is wonderful, but when I talk to the child, I find out what are their hobbies, what are their interests, what are things that are important to them, what are their values, what are their goals. However, just like when we have a child who is looking for a job and let's say they're an accountant and you know a lot of people who are accountants, so you network for them. Oh, are you looking for someone? Can I send you my son or daughter's information? So too, as a parent, we can do that. Very often if you're sitting at a wedding or at any kind of simcha or any kind of get-together, you could say, oh, my daughter or my son is dating. Maybe you know someone. Everyone knows someone. Everyone has cousins and relatives and neighbors, and everyone can help network for other people. If you actually get a name and you don't know what to do with it, so you always can reach out to me or to any of the people that I work with, and we can help suggest the idea for you. But definitely take your cue from your child. If a child wants your involvement, definitely be involved, but also encourage them to be proactive in their own life.
Thank you so much. Mrs. Herkman, a lot of times a young man, a young woman, their confidence is shot because they get a suggestion they're excited about and the other party says no. Or they dated somebody a few times, the other party says shanta no, or goes on for a month, and there's been a lot of disappointment in their lives. How can a parent, or how can even a Rebbe or a Moro or anybody instill confidence, instill, I guess, to encourage the young person to be able to continue with confidence and poise and self-worth, self-value, in a world where, unfortunately, a lot of disappointment can come through the dating process?
Sure. So I'm going to start with the analogy I often use for dating, which is it's like you're looking for parking in Manhattan. And if you've ever gone to Manhattan for an event, you hope a few things, that you'll find a spot quickly, very close to your destination, with minimal maneuvers. If you've ever done a parking spot with like one maneuver, you feel like there should be like a wall of fame for that. So I find with dating, so it's very similar, right? So if you start driving around the block and you see a fire hydrant, obviously, because a lot of spots have hydrants, you get to a point where any spot you see, you assume there's a fire hydrant. So if you've ever called someone to try to set them up, or someone has called you to set you up, it's very hard to get excited about something, or it's very easy to sometimes hear the person resistant because they're really looking for the fire hydrant, because they're thinking, this is too good to be true. If this was a regular spot, someone else would have taken it by now, right? So there's that first piece of that defeatist kind of pessimism that kicks in, where people feel like, They've been around the block so many times that it's hard for them to believe that something good might be happening to them, that they actually found a spot. And then the other piece of it is, I think, even if they find a spot, it's like, okay, so there's no fire hydrant, there's no standing sign, there's maybe some cracked paint on the curb, but you're like, no, I think it's a spot. But you keep trying over and over, and you don't know, is this a spot that I could get into, but I'm just not maneuvering it right? Or am I going to drive away from a spot that actually could have been a good spot, but I just wasn't able to see closely, or sometimes there's someone on the sidewalk who's like, hey, I'll coach you, right? So there's the maneuvering piece, and then the last piece is the replenishing piece, right? If you keep driving around the block, your gas tank is going to get lower, right? You could have great music on, you could be really positive, you could be davening, whatever it is, like, you're still going to be draining energy from yourself. So these pieces are all at play. So when somebody is struggling with confidence, I think it's helpful to have language not just for them, but for ourselves. If we're helping someone, if we're trying to be there for them, it's helpful, especially as a parent, to understand the aspects of that that hit home for us. In other words, our own emotional roller coaster of feeling like we're driving around the block, or our own sense of fatigue with trying to maneuver, of calling different shadchanim or doing this or doing that, or even just your own sense of feeling drained. Now, in terms of the confidence piece, I think part of this, again, depends on the situation. If somebody has always had a very low self-esteem, so dating is going to probably exacerbate. I mean, I think dating in general exacerbates all of your insecurities. I think when people get rejected, everything that they don't like about themselves will probably come to the surface louder. But I think if somebody struggles with confidence in general, even before they're dating, it's going to get worse. The question of what do I say, right? This thing of like, what is the magic thing to say? What I find sometimes gets lost here is that sometimes it's really not about what you say, right? People want to feel seen, not solved. When someone's in a place of pain, they want to feel presence, not pity. And this thing of like, if I say the right thing and this, and I'll lift them up. And yes, there are things that we can be saying in terms of encouraging and all that. But I find that very often it's actually about slowing it down and being there and saying something like, what do you need from me right now? Do you need me to listen, or did you want feedback on that? Do you want comfort, or do you want solutions, right? We want to help people amplify their own voice, because maybe they need a pep talk, or maybe in that moment they actually don't need a pep talk. But the more we can create language and dialogue of what they actually need in that moment, then we can show up better for what they might need without feeling like we're pushing, but also not feeling like we're not doing enough.
Thank you so much. Rabbi Leibowitz, a lot of times people have insecurities about something that was in a previous existence in high school or before, or something about a family and revealing maybe something difficult in their family or in their past, or maybe in the same category. I'm sure you serve the reference for many different families. At what point, halakhically, does somebody have to reveal something challenging from their past? Or would you say that somebody, as a reference, has to reveal something which could be challenging about the family? I know this is very obtuse, this is a hard question to answer in only a couple of minutes, but please share some insights. Thank you so much.
Wow, you weren't kidding when you said you changed all the questions. I did not do that one either. Okay. Without thinking, I will tell you as follows that I think that there are a lot of different types of information. There are a lot of different things that fit in the category, the general broad strokes that you just painted about things from the past. Things from the past may include minor high school indiscretions, experiences with a boyfriend or girlfriend in high school, or things of that nature. When it comes to something like that, you know, a kid grew up in a modern Orthodox home, in a modern Orthodox school. Now he's all yeshivish and whatever. He does not have to tell. I don't think he should ever tell his wife this details and specifics about, you know, what his experiences were with girls and what he did and who he was with. And I don't think that's necessary. She knows the kind of environment he grew up in. If she really pushes him, she asks questions, he can be as vague as possible. I don't think it's healthy to really, I think that would just get into the spouse's head. It will create an unhealthy sense of, and I'm not a therapist, I really don't know what I'm talking about. But is my, am I right about that?
You're good.
It seems to me to be unhealthy. Yet, when it comes to other things, things that, illness or other types of matters that may impact future life rather than just what was in the past, and it's something that is known or must be known, I often find that when an ally of the person who in question is the one that reveals the information, it could be revealed in the most positive way, with the most balance, meaning you don't want to be the one to not say anything, and then they hear it on the street from someone who kind of knows, but you know the way they heard it is 10 times worse than what it really is, and that's how the other person finds out about it. Much, much better to be straightforward from earlier on, and to frame it in a way where you're able to frame it with nuance and with the proper perspective on who the person is. Again, that's also very vague, but that's something that's like, if it's something that's common knowledge. If it's a matter of a genetic test or something like that, where it's not common knowledge, so then I wouldn't say that it has to be revealed immediately, nor do I think it can, you know, it can you can hold off on ever revealing it, but that probably after a few dates at some point where there's some connection, where there's some reason to believe that there's potential, then at some later point, again, depending on what the issue is, the question was phrased vaguely, depending on what the issue is, should be revealed at some different time. And that's clear.
Thank you. You're on my list.
May I add just something?
Absolutely.
Thank you. If I might just add, Rabbi Leibowitz, one of the things that we recommend at Life Connects is when a relationship starts, when people are dating and it starts to progress to what we consider to be a relationship, so we don't ask information, but we very often will say, if at this point there's something that you feel that you need to reveal to the other person, this would be a good time. Because if you wait too long, then the person is never going to trust you because it's going to come out and they'll, well, why didn't they tell me this? If they didn't tell me this, what else are they hiding? So we always recommend that when it's looking like it's becoming a relationship, if there's something to reveal, this would be the right time to mention it to the other person.
Beautiful addition. Thank you very much. The next question probably could be for any one of the panelists, and feel free to chime in, but maybe I'll ask Ms. Osman, because it's relevant mostly to why you connect other such venues. A lot of people ask the following question. There's an expectation, and Halakha probably dictates this also, really would speak to that also, about a shanchan fee. And a lot of times people are overwhelmed by the concept of whether it's a charlatan charging a very high fee and makes them anxious because how can they ever cover that, on top of, God willing, the cost of making a wedding. That seems to be something which people do not look favorably upon. The question is, what balance do you feel that shadchanim have in terms of course, getting compensated for their time and commitment, whether it's organizations, whether it's individual shadchanim, versus not deterring a young man, a young woman, or even maybe a family who can ill afford to pay for such a gift in terms of the shidduch? What do you think the role of the gift is in terms of the shidduch?
Also a new question, so feel free to chime in, Rabbi Lewis, if you have any insight. So people have to recognize that most matchmakers work without compensation, sort of like a real estate broker, right? A real estate broker could take you to many, many houses, and you don't necessarily find the right one with that real estate broker, and yet someone else shows you a house, and that's the house you end up going with. And people know that from the goodness of their heart, they're trying to find someone for your child. But there isn't necessarily compensation involved. I think it's something that people just are not accustomed to. But when you become accustomed to something, you recognize that makes sense. So two, there are so many times that people are giving gifts for things. Oh, someone did something nice for me, so I'm going to give them a gift, whether it's a gift certificate to Amazon, someone started driving my child in a carpool, I want to give them something. So it's a very important point, not from a halakhic perspective even, but from a Hakaras HaTov perspective, to give someone something nice if they're doing a good deed for you, if they're helping you out. Like I said, most matchmakers are not being paid, so therefore there is no compensation. I'm not a firm believer that people should have these set fees. I think very high fees are very scary for people, and they can also drain. I know at Wyatt Connects we do not have a set fee. We have a recommended fee. We recommend a certain amount to the organization and a certain amount to the shadchan, but we also let people know if they are not capable, then it's okay. They give what they are capable to give. I know that when I have made weddings, there were many fees that came up that I was shocked. The price of the band, the price of the flowers, even to get makeup done. So all these things become new when you start looking into avenues for a wedding. So too, if there was a matchmaker involved, a matchmaker fee. So I think it should be just one of those things that gets tacked on. Oh, just like now I'm going to get my hair done, so now I'm also going to make sure to have a Hakaras HaTov and give a compensation to the matchmaker. Please.
I just want to add that, you know, intuitively, if someone would have asked me this without me having ever learned any svarim, I would have said, what do they need the money for? You know, it's a nice chesed to do for other people, and it's something we should all be trying to do. And, you know, I would have gone in that direction, how money ruins everything, and now you have shadchanim for the stars that, you know, that will only do shidduchim for families with a net worth in, you know, eight figures, and will charge whatever. And, you know, all that is terrible, obviously. But at the same time, it's important to recognize there is significant halachic literature about paying shadchanim. It is something that we believe in. It's something that the halacha requires, just like you pay anyone else who does work for you. Shadchanim work hard, and it's really important work. They're doing something that we value a great deal. I too am very sensitive to the expenses that people are going through when they make a wedding. It's a lot. It's a lot more than they've ever spent on anything else, usually, in their lives. When I do chassan classes, I always tell the chassan, nothing is fine also. You don't have to give me anything. If I'm sure your parents are very stressed and financially, and that's really okay. Do not start calling me for chassan classes. but But that's, you know, you have to be sensitive to what people are going through. But I don't think the place to cut is by cutting out the shadchan. The shadchan introduced this young couple that, you know, and that's what we're celebrating, the ability of the young couple to be married and make a life together. There are other places in simchas that you can cut. Some of them were mentioned before. There are other places where you can maybe go a little bit lower, you know, before you cut out the shadchan.
Thank you so much.
Can I add something just small?
Absolutely. I was going to add something to that.
Go first.
Now, I was just going to say, I also do many chasen lessons of Baruch Hashem, and through this past Shabbos, and I also, you should know, also tell people I don't ask for a gift, but I always tell people to give it to a tzedakah. That's always a nice thing to do, and the shacharim can also do that, obviously, but they do deserve compensation for the time, the balance of the two.
Thank you. I think it's also a good practice to teach our kids the sense of gratitude, not just when we get what we wanted, right? I think this idea of shadchanos, because it worked out, is one thing. But I think any time any shadchan does anything for anyone, setting someone up, reading, you know, trying whatever, it's really helpful to send a text, hey, thank you so much for your time. I remember when I was single, there was someone who would always try to set me up, and I'd always send a thank you text. And she said to me, you know, you're one of the only people who does that. And I'm saying this not to pat myself on the back, but to me it seemed so absurd that, what do you mean, people, you set people up and they don't text you to thank you that you set them up? And she said, no, I don't hear from them again. Like, I don't even know if it worked out, or I'll 6 months later bump into them at Gourmet Glad and clearly it didn't work out. So I think even just, I think Hakar Satovin gratitude is something that we try to indoctrinate in our children long before they're in the dating world, right? This idea that people get married and then all of a sudden every year is about, you need to make your spouse feel appreciated and things like that. All of these things start way before that. So I think even just this idea of gratitude, and again, the shadchan, you know, the shadchan guilt in terms of how much, it's not my department, but I think even just this idea of teaching our kids that we say thank you even for like little things. It's not just because the marriage worked out in the end. Someone tries, someone gives us our time, you know, their time, whatever, say thank you, you know. So even just voice notes, even, something like that. I think even we could, there's the big stuff, but also the smaller stuff.
Excellent point, thank you so much. Mrs. Herkman, and this is like three parts to the same question, but I'll try to get it all into one smooth question. Communication. I'll tell you, when I was dating, I got my first cell phone. It was 2001 or 2002, and it was expensive to call. I remember the days where you couldn't just text or WhatsApp, and so you had to get out of the car, and you had to ring the doorbell and meet the parents and say hello and be polite and have a good etiquette. Obviously, that's changed a lot since 2001. And the question to focus in is, how do you foster healthy communication between a prospective boy and girl in a world where most of the communication is by WhatsApp texting? There's not really technically an obligation to meet the parents until, who knows, maybe things are very serious because they can just text, I'm outside, or something of that nature. On the other hand, also, when they communicate after a date, let's say there's no shadchan involved anymore, I would imagine, besides the phone, of course, there's a lot of texting and WhatsApping and shorthand notes. How do you balance the modern method of communication with being proper to meet parents and also trying to teach people to properly communicate and talk to each other in a normal, old-fashioned way?
Sure, this is... I think that changed in terms of the cell phones when Verizon started after 9 o'clock. A lot of cell phones after 9 o'clock, it was free. And then there was texting, free to Verizon. I don't know about the other ones. But I think that when we're talking about types of communication, I think it's helpful for any couple, whether they're dating or married, to have a distinction between what are the things we text about, what are the things we talk about live, let's say by phone or by FaceTime, and what are the things we take care of when we see each other in person. And I think when a couple is dating, it's very helpful to have that organization too. In other words, texting might be more like closed-ended statements or things related to like, oh, I'm running 10 minutes late, things like that. But texting shouldn't be like, yeah, well, in 5 years, I want to live in West Hempstead, but you're saying you want to live in Woodmere. Like, that shouldn't be a text message conversation. And, you know, we laugh about it, but it for many couples, it's pretty wild how many couples are having these, where do you see yourself in 5 years, conversations through text. And I think it doesn't have to be all or nothing. But what I find, one of the issues I see happening is that there are many girls, many women in the dating world who feel very apprehensive about trying to ask for certain standards or certain ways of dating because they don't want to upset the other person. So they, let's say, get set up with someone. And again, I'm using, you know, the girl and the guy, let's say, but he's into texting and she's not really into it, but she doesn't want to say anything. She doesn't want to, like, offend him, and she wants to keep dating him. So one of the things I suggest to people is tell the person early on, say, listen, I would love to get to know you in real time, so can we use texting for X and Y? Right? You're saying something in a complimentary way. You're saying, I want to get to know you in real time, right? Because what ends up happening through text is, like, you can't gauge somebody's authenticity. People are very witty through text, right? So great, your emojis have awesome compatibility. So, like, now your phones can have a beautiful marriage, right? But I think it doesn't have to be one or the other. And telling kids don't text at all, I don't think that's going to work, because then we just sound very old-fashioned. Like, not understanding the world that they're in. But I think there's a certain depth that we can experience when we're getting to know someone when we're not texting. So I think saying, hey, listen, like, texting is awesome for certain things, right? When we're starting to date, I think we can empower both the boys and the girls of, like, there are certain things we use texting for, certain things is better for live conversations, certain things that are better in person. And I think when you have options, and even when you say it in a complimentary way, not like, please stop texting me at work, just saying, like, what's up? Like, someone went out once, like, there shouldn't be a text the next day, like, what's up? Like, hey. Like, that, no, that's not anything. It's like, oh my God, we have good texting chemistry. Okay, cool, it could be a bot. But point is that there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that's going to scare the person away by saying, hey, like, I'd love to get to know you in real time. Can we use texting maybe for X or Y? And guess what? If that scares them away, great. Eliminate them early. Because if that's someone who only wants to text and that's where they feel most comfortable, we want to know that early on. Because otherwise it's just going to schlep along, and then we're going to have that problem later on. We're going to kick the can down the road. And then what? The Texan's going to be like, honey, can we talk? You know, like, the finances. Like, meaning it's better early on. And I think we don't have to be so scared of asking for certain standards of how we want to date someone. And if they're not up for that, then okay, then we move on. But this fear, I think, is something that's big for a lot of people.
Thank you so much. This question is for all the panelists. Anybody can feel free to answer. This question came up that they went to 7 times over the email, so I'll just ask it to all the panelists. There's a general feeling, and I think many of us in the room feel this way, that in the world of 50-50, in terms of shidduchim, there's probably about an 80-20 advantage that the boys have over the girls. There's a general feeling, and I think, can we all... It's okay if you feel that way. It's okay. I feel the same way, and around 100%. The question is, I think it's part of a dialogue, and as many people in the email wrote, that everyone recognizes it, they understand it, everyone admits it, even the men, myself, and many of my colleagues, many of my friends also understand that and admit it. And yet, somehow it seems to not change. The question is, what can we do as families, as a community, just in general, to be able to, I guess, and I apologize to use this phrase, even the playing field, and give our fantastic young women a chance to really have confidence and advocate for themselves and be able to have just as much of an advantage in terms of getting the proper matches and also having the opportunity to be able to advocate for themselves in the shidduch world. I don't know where to pass the microphone. Any takers? I'm going to pass it to somebody.
You know, I'll start. Okay. I know everyone will have more answers as well. It happens to be a great question, and I actually think the people that should be answering this question are all of you who are attending today.
I recently met a woman that I grew up with, I babysat for when she was in West Hempstead, and she came over to me at a wedding, and she said to me, you know, my daughter's coming back from Israel very soon, and I'm going to be in touch, because, you know, I want her to start dating. So I looked at her, and I said, don't you have a son at YU? I'm going to say by now he must be like 22. So she said to me, yeah, but I'm not even worried about him. I'm worried about her. And I wonder if maybe one of the reasons why we're having this issue of where we feel that the girls are at a disadvantage, or there are more girls than guys, guys are getting more suggestions than girls, is because we're so focused and so concerned for the girls. I will tell you, as a matchmaker, I have so many boys as well that are feeling that girls are not giving them a chance. Girls are also saying no to them. And while many of you might have daughters, if you have sons, you might be aware of this as well. And it's just that for whatever reason, the hype is more about the daughters. But I can honestly say that there are also many young men within this community that I work with that feel a little dejected, or feel that they're not getting a fair shake, or girls are not saying yes to them. I think we need to recognize that. Sometimes we gloss over it and we're just focused on the girls, and that's why we have this sense. And it's an exciting time dating, but it's also a stressful time. And I think that we need to also make it just a part of our kids' life and not the only part of our kids' life.
I'm going to let everyone continue the conversation.
As someone who deals with boys most of the time, I would say that what Mindy said is definitely true, that boys struggle too. It's not all easy for the boys. You know, it's not like they just always have an easy time with dating for a number of reasons. However, where I don't know if I'm disagreeing, but I think there's a numbers problem. I mean, I think like there's an undeniable numbers problem. I mean, how many times have I heard the line, no boy is dating until he's engaged? You know, you keep hearing, he's not dating yet, not dating yet, not dating yet, mazel tov, he's engaged. And that seems to happen a lot. So I think that's a real problem. You know, I'm more focused on the boys becoming balei kaiva and arrogant and thinking that they're God's gift to humanity because they have all of these suggestions of girls, and they have their choice of who to go out with. And, you know, I try to explain to them, it's really not about you. You're really not that great. It's a numbers problem. You know, my son often likes to say that he is living proof of the shidduch crisis, because my daughter-in-law is awesome. He's like, in the real world, I should have no chance with a girl like this. I'm like, right. I think that it is a problem. I think that it could be very easy for a young lady to start feeling dejected and sad and upset and to start feeling hopeless. I think we have to, I don't know what the answer is, but there needs to be something done about the numbers problem. But as far as dealing with an individual young lady, an individual young woman, we have to really do a lot of work in terms of building her up for all of her other accomplishments. She cannot be completely defined by, are you married or are you not married, which our community tends to do. There has to be more to her life and more that defines who she is, her sense of self-worth, and her sense of accomplishment. And all that while, like the rest of us, working on the understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, and that Yeshua is Hashem Ke'arev Ayin, and a sense, a profound, deep sense of emunah. But again, that is not a solution to the broader problem. I don't have a solution to the broader problem. That is just some suggestions in terms of how to deal with the young men and young ladies individually.
Thank you so much. Mrs. Herkman, Did you want to add that?
I have, like, so much to say. So I'm like, which part should I? I'll add something to it.
Yes, okay, absolutely. Next question is yours anyway. So.
Okay, so what's the next question?
Should I ask the question first?
I'll do a mashup.
Beautiful. Wow. That's quite a talent. Fantastic. Okay. I'll ask the question. If it's still different, I'll ask it again in a minute.
I told you it's like a game show.
That's right. I'm going to buzz you in when you... A lot of times, there's one word that I think, and I'll use the word that I like to use, because I'm sure there are other ways to, other words to describe it. It's the word therapy. It's a stigma word. It's a trigger word for a lot of people. A lot of couples will start dating, they'll date for a month, and they'll break up. A lot of couples will be engaged, and they will have challenges in the communications, and thinking about breaking it off. Sometimes somebody will or won't suggest, maybe you should get couples therapy, which is pre-marriage. Obviously, if somebody's post-marriage, 100%, they should have marriage counseling, 100%. In the world we live in today, therapy is a trigger word, again, the stigma word. How can we promote a healthy way to recommend to couples who are either dating or engaged that there's nothing wrong with getting therapy to help them either get over some insecurities or get over some focus they have that really shouldn't be there, when to recommend, when not to recommend, when to step in if a therapist or anybody notices that this relationship is not healthy also might be a factor. I know that's probably outside the purview of this question, but just putting it all together in your mash.
So I thought it was interesting that you said therapy is a trigger word. Because
not for me, I'm saying.
No, for people. Because I think that for some people, they hear the word therapy, and it's like, oh, I'm a failure, I'm broken, or my shefela is not perfect. You think my shefela needs therapy? And the thing is that this does tie into the previous question about numbers, which I'm going to respectfully disagree. I do feel like there's a numbers issue sociologically in society in general also.
I didn't say it wasn't but, a numbers yeah. problem. I just want to make sure that
no, and I think boys, I will say that I think one issue we do have in our culture is that we have this thing that the boys are fine with rejection. That's why we ask the boys first. We should ask the boy first, because if she says no, like, he's just going to like wipe it off his bulletproof vest and just continue on like rejection. What? She, I don't even know her. And rejection hurts men too. So I do think that kind of lopsidedness, there are a lot of women who get married and are like, oh, you have feelings as a man? Because I was told that you just, nothing bothers you because in the shit-up world you have a suggestion every day. In terms of how this ties into therapy, I think it actually does, because what ends up happening is that when girls grow up hearing this narrative about this scarcity mindset, it definitely affects people's standards and the sense of dating someone, and I really don't think or feel like this might be a good fit for me or my long-term forever person, but I don't know what else is out there, and so I should just stay with this person, even though there may be real compatibility issues. So I do find that fear and that insecurity of I'm not going to find someone, and we're seeing this in people who are 19 and 20 already. They're having this fear. So I do think that it ties into therapy, because there's these major insecurities, and there's this sense that, you know, in our community, because marriage, and I think this is something beautiful about Judaism, especially in society that doesn't always value family, that we are very family-oriented, and there's something great about that. But for those who are struggling to find a partner, it feels like it's the admission ticket to get into the stadium, and they're just tailgating outside, and there's all this action on the inside, and then people on the inside are like, oh, they're sitting out there because they're just having such a great time tailgating. And it's like, they don't really want to be sitting there the whole time, but they want to be part of things. In terms of therapy, so the way I see it is that there's a lot of benefits to therapy, but because there's stigma around it, like if somebody's struggling with exercise, I don't usually hear people say, let me keep working out for another year or two, and then I'll call a personal trainer. You know, I'll see if I still don't have results, and then I'll call a trainer. But with therapy, it's like, no, I really want to figure this out myself. We value self-sufficiency, do it yourself, things like that. I actually would add to that, sometimes people ask me if I feel that, because I work also in the Hasidic and Yeshivish community, if I find that therapy is less stigmatized in the non-Orthodox world versus, you know, more right-wing circles, I actually find that in more right-wing circles, because Das Torah is so part of your life, and when you're struggling with something, there will be a shorter window of your struggle in you telling someone, versus in many of our communities, we have more of this Western concept of self-sufficiency, I should be able to do things myself. Anyway, I feel like I'm on a tangent. Going back to the question about therapy, I'm definitely past 3 minutes, but in terms of the question about therapy, I think that, like many things, if we wait till the dating period to start introducing the concept of therapy, or introducing the concept of needing help, or needing to talk to someone, that's just going to add certain challenges. Now, I think therapy can help people in many ways, and I've seen from a premarital perspective, it can really help a lot. But I think creating more emphasis on this idea that we were never supposed to do things on our own. Like, it does take a village. And we are so focused on, I need to do things myself, and if I can't do it myself, I'm a failure. And there's a certain objectivity about ourselves that we can't have. We can't have, there's a limit to that. And I would only add to that I think that with therapy, people have this fear that they're going to be in therapy for the rest of their lives, and that doesn't have to be the case. And I think that the idea of therapy from a privacy perspective, I do want to throw out there that because of HIPAA and we have privacy laws, when you go to a therapist, unless you share that you have made serious plans to hurt yourself or somebody else, anything you share there is totally confidential. And so even if someone does not go to therapy, if they are going to be talking to people about their dating lives, it's really important that it's someone who they can be open with about what's happening for them, their struggles, their insecurities, what's going on in the relationship, if there's red flags, if there's Shomer Nagia situations that they need to talk to, whatever it is, if people don't have others that they can talk to and be open about what's going on, it makes it much more difficult for people to be able to help them. And so the privacy perspective, I think, is something to think about. Now, therapy doesn't have to be the only place that we have that. I think that if we have more privacy and spaces for vulnerability, we wouldn't need therapists as much. So all this to say that I think as a community, I think we've come a really long way in terms of therapy. I would say right now, I can't find referrals for people. Meaning, I think supply and demand-wise, the demand for therapy in the Orthodox world now is so much higher than the supply of Orthodox therapists. And I don't think we've seen this before. The pandemic has done that to a certain extent. But all this to say, I think we've made progress in this regard, but I think the value of what kind of values do I have in my home when it comes to I'm struggling with something, can I ask for help? For anything. Because that's where we have the building blocks of that sense of humility and surrender of I'm not okay, or I'm nervous I won't be okay. I need to find a space where I can talk this out and get support.
Did I say something about the numbers answering, or you don't take from the audience yet?
I deeply apologize. We're just almost out of time. I apologize. Can you give me a few minutes? Thank you so much.
All I wanted to say was that the only solution I've seen with the numbers problem is women dating a little bit younger.
My husband is 2 years younger than me, so we joke that we sell the shit.
And then my mom was older than whatever, my father. And the other thing was, the other problem with the men is, okay, they might be capable of feeling rejected, but on the flip side, it's that they know they have so many fish in the sea. It's like, she's good, but I might be much better. So it's like the flip side of the
world. I totally hear you, but I also, pardon me, and I'm all for us being sensitive to everyone.
I find
men sometimes are being characterized in the dating world as not having the same emotions that women do. They're expected to be a lot of things in one person. So I totally hear your comment.
May I add one thing to my question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I know when Rachel was talking before, she mentioned that sometimes people just want to vent, and we have to ask them, are you looking for solutions, or do you just want to be heard? But I do believe that some people here are thinking, but isn't there some kind of solution? So it happens to me that my good friend Margie Glatt has a great idea that for some reason I think doesn't always take off. I think because kids don't want to be so proactive, but she calls it chevra brachot, that if once a couple gets engaged,
if one of the friends, if they specifically designate one of the friends of the girls and one of the friends of the guys to speak to each other and make a sheva brachot one night for the chevra, right? If this is my good friend and these are his good friends, we might have a lot in common. And this would give, every time your child goes to a wedding, they, besides celebrating their friend's simcha, they know there's an opportunity right afterwards for them to perhaps meet some people that they may not have met in any other social setting. And I really encourage, as a community, I know the West Hempstead community does so many wonderful things, and if you can jump on that bandwagon and you can try and encourage the kids, or even help perhaps, if I might say, pay for the pizza or the Chinese, it might really make a very big difference, and I think it'll make all the daters feel like, wow, not only am I going to my friend Simcha, but I'm also going to this social event afterwards that is for kids, by kids.
It's an excellent point. I would add, actually, as a community rabbi, I'm not going to speak for anyone else, but I think that we have to encourage men and women to be able to do the same. Sometimes people feel discouraged, that there's somehow a stigma against having some kind of coeducational event or a Sheva Brachos. When somebody comes to us and asks us, I think it's important to say it's a healthy way to meet organically, and I think that if we can kind of, I guess, lower the level of the angst people have at making kinds of events like that, it would go a long way in terms of encouraging people to do those kinds of events. Sure.
I just want to add, I'm sorry to go back to a previous thing, but I feel very passionately about this, about therapy. All of my evidence is anecdotal, but, you know, that's what you get when you don't invite an expert. I mean, when you invite someone who's not an expert. I'm finding that in the next generation, there's less and less stigma around therapy, which is wonderful. I can tell you, I had an experience this past summer. I learned with a group of young men in Camp Cayley over the summer, and because I don't know how to run anything, they hire someone to actually run the program. I just teach them Torah. So the fellow who's running the program is a young. There were two guys that were running the program. One single, one married. And the married fellow was like Mr. Cool. Everyone looked up to him. He was like, you know, the guy that every other guy wanted to be. And one Friday night, late Friday night, I was supposed to run a tish, but I don't know how to run anything. So I don't know how to run a tish, I don't know how to sing. So I said, guys, we'll go around the table. I'm asking you a question. What's the nicest thing or the best thing anyone's ever done for you? And we just went around, and each of this one said, my mom did this, this one said, my Rebbe did that. And then we got to, like, the cool guy that everyone wanted to be. He was a super Ben Torah and smart and good-looking and tall and all the good things, right? And he said, my therapist. I never would have been able to get married to my wife. I never would have had the courage. I never would have gotten through it without my therapist. And he said that publicly in front of 20 young men who look up to him and who admire him. And to me, that was such a moment. And it told me a lot about the changing landscape in terms of therapy. Now, to that end, I would encourage everybody here who has children in the parsha. I think pre-marriage counseling and Shalom workshops and the like is very, very important. I once had someone who's a person of extraordinary means. That's what you call a really rich person, right? So a person of extraordinary means called me up, and he said to me, "I'm thinking of doing something big. If I would give you $100 million for a project, what would it be?" And I said, "To pay for every engaged couple to have pre-marriage counseling for a couple of sessions before, a couple of sessions after." It didn't resonate with him. He said, "Oh, we figured it out when we were young. But again, for that generation, it didn't resonate. I think it would resonate a lot with the next generation to learn about how to handle stress related to finances, related to all of us, right? In-laws, related to all of the things that come up, the various frustrations in life, how to build a healthy relationship. A lot of the kids, just they don't know how. And when there are problems later on, they don't have an address. because they never met a therapist before. So they wait and wait and wait and wait, and finally, after things get really, really bad, they go to the rabbi and say, we're really struggling over here. And by then, a lot of times there's been a lot of damage by that point. So if everyone had this premarital counseling, a couple of sessions before you get married, a couple of sessions right after you get married, and then like you go through a rough patch, you have a phone number, you have a person that knows you that you can connect with, and it's just an easy phone call. You know what? Let's go to our person, our guy, our doctor, our woman who we go to that will help us through this. I think it's worth the money. I think it's something we need to make like a standard in the and I should add, it should be a from therapist. I mean, we need more from therapists, as Rachel said before. I think it's very when you're dealing with, I have nothing against non from people. I love non from people. I love all people. But when you're dealing with a non from therapist, you will spend the first 10 sessions explaining what Shabbos is, to then describe why it's a problem that the husband comes home drunk 3 o'clock in the afternoon for Shabbos day lunch. What do you mean? Just eat lunch without him? No, that's not the way it works. That's not, meaning it's too much. There's too many cultural things to get past. We need a lot of front therapists.
I wanted to share actually a success story. It's important to hear success stories that before last week, a young woman who got engaged, Baruch Hashem, last week had called me about 8-9 months ago. She was dating somebody for quite a long time, and everything sounded great. And I kept asking every conversation, everything sounds great, wonderful. She said, I just don't think this is for me. And I said, why? Everything's great. After about 3 months, I said, like you said, I recommend you go to a therapist to kind of talk through these things. She said, Rabbi, why? I said, I'm not a Navi. You know why? Because they're going to tell you the same thing that I told you. This is great. She went to a therapist for 2 months. The therapist talked through the issues with her, and it was great. And she got engaged last week. So I think, Baruch Hashem, success. So I think that, again, the Leibowitz said that, I always say about myself that I'm just a facilitator, that part of, I'm also a novice, by the way, because you weren't aware of that, that part of being a parent or a rabbi, anyone who's in the position of guidance, is to tell somebody when it's appropriate to go to a therapist and know that it's beyond your expertise. And that sometimes, as you said before, it's not a stigma, it should be encouraged, because it could really help the person get over the bump to get into the next stage of the relationship. And then we're...
Can I add something to the therapy piece?
Absolutely.
So, something I wanted to mention that I see that always breaks my heart when I hear stories like this, where people will sometimes go to a therapist, a from therapist, who was very directive in encouraging a person to get married to a person. And there are therapists that are more directive than others, for sure, but like no therapist can clear someone. Meaning, so there's a situation where it's like a couple's dating and there's concern that someone has a drinking problem. So they went to a therapist and the therapist met with them twice and said, no, don't worry, they're not an alcoholic. You know, don't worry, mazel tov, get married. And I find one of the issues that I see is that When a couple chooses to get married, they need to be able to look back on that decision. Even if they had help along the way of people mentoring them, they need to be able to look back on that decision and say, we made that decision and we own that choice. It can't be, oh, the therapist told us that everything would be fine, so we got married. Or the Rav said this. And I say this in defense of the therapist or the Rav. They can only work with what's in front of them, right? This is where I think psychology is different than medicine, because if you go to an endocrinologist and you're going over the bloods and they're looking at your A1C and diabetes, like there's a little more objectivity there than you might have when you're talking about therapists. And sometimes couples or sometimes parents will rely on the therapist's reassurance that this relationship is going to be okay. And I think that there's a lot of limitations in that, especially when a couple or a person is only coming to therapy in that crisis mode, right? Whenever someone comes to me in crisis and I'm like, whoa, slow down, I'm meeting you for the first time. What do you like to do for fun? Who are you? Like, I don't even know this person yet, right? So you get a therapist meeting someone or meeting a couple and telling them, well, you guys, you're wonderful. I think you should go ahead and get married. I think it's important that whatever that couple chooses to do, they are owning that choice, that they are choosing to get married. Because at the end of the day, and I think we, and I tell this to kids all the time, you're the one going home with that person after the wedding. Not your therapist, not your rabbi, not your Majikan seminary, not your rakezet, not your, you know, cousin's dog's owner's friend, all these things. You're the one who's going to be living with this person. So we need to have that sense of accountability. And yes, we are here to support and cheerlead and help people process feelings. But I will say one caveat. I do find that when people are finding themselves in an abusive relationship, whether it's emotionally abusive or verbally, physically, sexually, whatever it is, it can be more difficult for people to be in touch with their intuition because their whole nervous system is hijacked. So I would suggest that it, you know, Shalom Task Force, people have a certain picture in their head of what abuse looks like or what an abuser looks like. They have a hotline. I have colleagues there who are amazing. If there's a situation that you're dealing with where you're concerned about something like that and you're trying to talk sense into your kid and they're not able to hear it, find the addresses, find the people that you can talk to help you through that. Because that those situations, I find, we do have to be more directive with people who are in those situations. And it's important that we're talking to the right people who have all the information they need. Because, like I said, different helpers along the way can only work with what's shared with them.
Thank you so much. The hour is very late. I'm going to conclude with maybe one or two more questions, and we'll end the program. I want to end on a positive note, but the next question unfortunately came up 4 or 5 times, and it's not a positive question, so I apologize. Maybe we'll share some thoughts of the individual thoughts from the panelists, if that's okay. It's not on the sheet, but we'll try. Most of the time, people will come to you when a shidduch or a relationship is not going well, and say, I'm concerned about this, I saw a red flag, and that's most of the time they'll come to a parent, a rebbe, a mora, somebody who they're close to, a friend. But more often than we think, and actually it's happened in my own rabbinic life more often than you would think, somebody is dating somebody else and things are going really well. Things are great. But again, you as the rabbi or rebbitzin, therapist, connector, shantachan, whatever it may be, you really see this is not a great relationship because something is unhealthy, whether it's about the boy, the girl, or just the chemistry is not healthy, and it's going to be, in your mind, at least, disastrous. The question was raised a few times, how does somebody know when to, as a parent, or as a friend, or as the shanchan, or whoever in the position of guidance, how do you know when to step in, knowing full well that the danger, in other words, you, if it's a good friend of yours, that could end your friendship. Imagine telling a friend that you think the person they're dating is not good for them. Or if you're a parent, you know, we all know people who maybe were afraid to speak up and the marriage was not a healthy one. How do you know when to step in and to raise concern in a, I guess, in a cautious way, but in a firm way?
Not it. I got to think about it.
I can tell some stories about my personal experience until you have a chance to think about it. Is that okay?
Do you
want to? I'll go after
it. First of all, I think it's good to start with something complimentary. So say, you know, the young man you're dating has such a nice tattoo. I think it's beautiful. His motorcycle is fantastic. It's really cool. But I think more importantly that when you have the conversation, you're not telling the person anything. What I think, again, this is totally unprofessional. I mean, not a professional's opinion, but you want to lead them to the conclusions on their own. So you would ask them, you know, if it's a values question. Have you discussed values? All right. Is there, what are his values? What are your values? You know, just to put the kinds of questions in their head that would lead them to that conclusion on their own. You're not going to be able to tell the person, this is bad for you, this is wrong for you. That's just going to create World War III, and especially if you're a parent, when they get married, then it's just going to be that friction is never going to go away. It's going to be very, very difficult. But to put the right questions in their head. Ultimately, people are adults and have to make their own decisions and live with their own decisions. But I think with most of the issues, many of the issues that come up, they could be solved earlier on. Meaning, if we're really raising our children in a healthy way, and we're preparing them properly for dating and the kinds of things to think about before they start dating, it would be very healthy. I was just at a Shavuot Brachos this past Shabbos, and the mother of the Kala said that when the Kala was in seminary, she had written a list of the qualities that she's looking for in a young man. And the mother of the Kala said, and I will now read to you that list. It was very funny, but it was like, it was amazing because she knew exactly what mattered to her. She knew exactly what she was looking for, and she found it. Because she knew what it was that she was looking for, and there were important things. I mentioned this to my mechatanim, and they said, yeah, our daughter also had such a list, and we were able to modify it for her. To show her that maybe this was not, you know, maybe not every item on the list was super duper important. And my son turned to me and said, yes, I was plan B. So that's, which is great, meaning that it's thought about in advance, it's thought about beforehand.
I think there are two separate issues right here. Number one is what Rabbi Lubowitz is talking about, which is when someone isn't sure that the values align is very different than when someone sees a red flag. I know that when I was teaching at Stern, very often friends would tell me that they were concerned, their friend was seeing someone, maybe he was abusive, they saw red flags. I have found 9.9 times out of 10 when a single friend tells her friend who's dating someone seriously that they don't think this guy is good for them, what that girl does is drop the friend, not drop the guy. So I'm not so sure that it's a good idea for a friend to be the one to say something. I think that this conversation should go back before a girl or a guy starts dating, as Rabbi Lieberwood says. When your child is ready to date, sit down with them, talk about values and goals that they see in your home and things that should matter to them, things that they should be looking for, such as honesty and kindness and flexibility. These are beautiful qualities. Things, and then even talk about qualities that perhaps are a little scary that they should be aware of that could show up and manifest themselves in someone, such as arrogance and anger. And this way, the conversation starts long before your child starts dating. However, if you see your child dating someone and there are things that you are concerned about, I actually recommend that you as a parent seek out a professional, a therapist, or a rav, because again, so often I have seen, unfortunately, that when a dater is or says they're in love with another person, instead of hearing their parents, they will then go tell the person they're dating, my parent doesn't like you, my parent doesn't think you're good enough for me. And then what happens is when this couple does get married, they, in a sense, separate themselves from the one person who really cares about that girl or that guy. So you also have to tread very carefully.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll go to the professional.
So it's very hard to condense, but I will say this. I think that it does depend on who's seeing the concerns, if it's coming from a friend or an adult. You know, red flags don't always wave. And I find that very often when there are marital struggles, retrospectively, the red flags were there, but those red flags weren't necessarily there when a couple is dating. I once heard someone say, they're like, yeah, there were red flags. I thought it was a carnival. So I do want to mention that this thing of like we're looking for these very dramatic signs. It's not always obvious, and I think especially in abbreviating dating circles. I would add another piece to this, that when a couple goes on a date, sometimes we're scared for them to talk openly about issues that they might have conflicts about. So instead of them talking about where they may not measure up hashkafically, you know, line up well, their people, I call the committee, people on the committee are talking it out for them. And one of the things that gets lost in that is the opportunity to see how you and this other person are able to have these conversations. And what I also find is that then there's missed opportunities to for the person to have more of this awareness of what am I uncomfortable with here? Because if someone else is talking out the real kishkas of building a relationship, then there could, then it's not as clear. So I do want to mention that. Another thing I would say is that, you know, identity and relationships are very intertwined, right? We're very into saying, like, you can't date unless you know who you are. But dating also teaches us about who we are. So we can raise our kids with every value in the world, but like everything else that we try in life, we're going to make mistakes and we may have to learn the hard way. And hopefully the hard way may not necessarily mean what our fears might be for our children, but to also understand that like parents could do everything right and their kids can still wind up in a relationship where there are concerns about compatibility. I do want to say another thing, that when a couple, when someone comes back from a date, sometimes the reflex is to right away for them to be unpacking it with someone close to them, a parent, a friend. I would really encourage people, and I always, whenever I'm working with people, informally, say, when you come back from a date, don't talk to anyone yet. Spend a half hour by yourself and just kind of sit and think about, how do you feel right now? It's not just how you felt with this person. How do you feel now that you walked away? Was there anything about it that just didn't seem right? Or, because there are things that you might tell over to someone else in a conversation, and the person hearing it is not going to be able to pick up what it is that you sensed in your kishkas sitting having your Diet Coke at the Marriott with this person. There, and they might, not only will they not be able to know, they might be able to talk it off and be like, listen, everyone's dead, there's no relationship that's perfect, right? So it's very important for us to, I think, kind of make more space after dates so that it's not just like it all hits the fan later, but also have more of that awareness all throughout. Something else I will throw out there is that I like to talk about emotional privilege. You know, we talk about financial privilege, racial privilege. I look at emotional privilege as having spaces and people where you can open up and be yourself and be vulnerable and share your emotions. And ideally, we have that in our homes. But even if we don't have that in our homes, you can find that in other places. Some people come to therapy to find that. Some people find that with Rebbeim, with mentors, in yeshiva maybe, at school, at seminary, whatever it is. I find that one of the hardest things for people in leaving a relationship is that they feel a sense of emotional privilege there. They feel like they are dating someone who gets them, who sees them, who understands them. And maybe it might be in a manipulative way, and we're not praising that. But to understand that what other people see as a problematic relationship, the person who's in it is often experiencing something that they may not have experienced before in terms of feeling affirmed or feeling understood. Now, this doesn't mean that we're going to encourage them, let's say, to go forward, but I think when someone on the outside is highly reactive and highly directive and isn't making space for the fact that even in dysfunctional and unhealthy relationships, there are parts of it that are very painful for people to leave and to grieve, it's a little easier to get a listening ear from that person who you're concerned about. Now, the other thing I would throw in, and I'm going to just try to talk fast, it does depend on what the issue is. If we're talking about compatibility, if we're talking about chemistry, if we're talking about behavior or things, you know, there's so many variables there of why are we concerned that this may not be a good fit. I will say that, like was mentioned, I do think it's helpful to talk it out. For the person who's concerned, it is helpful to talk it out, because then they can make space to understand, how much is this my own stuff, my own insecurities? Maybe I was hoping my kid would wind up with someone from this type of background or this type of thing, right? And that could be hard for some people to accept, but also to understand that parents can have a hunch on things, and kids sometimes underestimate how well their parents know them. I think kids underestimate how much their parents love them. And creating more nuance for all these different conversations is helpful before we're in that SOS, red flag, oh my gosh, what do we do? And the only other thing I would add is that I'm just based on my own experiences personally, I personally was willing to be dropped as a friend so that I could look back and know that I was Yotze and said something. But that was my own calculation. And it unfortunately was correct in the end, meaning what we were fearful about. But that's something a lot of people end up having to make that calculation of. Yes, they may be distanced as a friend, but how will they feel if they don't say something? And they feel like, I saw someone walking into oncoming traffic and I didn't honk and warn them. So that's my feeling. Do you want to end on a high note, though? I feel like we need, like, I don't know, tissues now.
By now.
So I was just going to say that I promised two things tonight. One, to end by 10 o'clock. That is gone. Number two, to end on a positive note. That's also gone, but that's okay. That's totally fine. But actually, I do want to add my own positive note. I think that one of the things that I sometimes forget, and I'm involved with teaching young men and young women in the community, outside the community, is that we have incredible people who are really dedicated to helping our children, guide them, and we have Rabbanim who are wonderful, we have therapists who are fantastic, we have matchmakers who are so passionate about the cause. And I think the fact that we have people like that who are there for us in this adventure, and it is an adventure. I'm not a roller coaster guy, but it's kind of like, you know, what's that thing in Sixth Class called where it has like seven loops and sometimes you're really excited, sometimes you want to throw up. It's kind of like that, one of those rides. But the fact that we have people, Rabbanim, therapists, and matchmakers who are there on the ride with us, I think gives me a lot of chizuk and should give all of us a lot of encouragement that we have people who are so supportive and dedicated to the cause. So thank you all for being here, for your insights. Please give them a round of applause. I want to end again by saying, always good to come full circle. This is not meant to be a one and done or meant to be a be-all, end-all. It is impossible to cover 5 pages of questions in one evening. And I think, hopefully, at the very least, we got food for thought. We, I think, in the shul and the community, welcome your ideas. This is meant to start the conversation, hopefully be the beginning of many events, many dialogue and conversations about this really important topic. As I said, it is not just for parents and singles. It is truly a community partnership. And we value your opinion in that, so thank you all for being here and looking forward to many more events and conversations together, God willing, coming up very soon. Thank you all, wishing you all a good week, and a good Yom Tov coming up.